name so that I could say hello and tell you to come visit me at victoriaswift.com sometime. My building may be old and dark, but it's a lot of fun. There are 9 floors, and each one takes you to a very different place. I think you'll be surprised by just where my link can go. Most people can't find me, but you will. I'm waiting for you. I think you'll have a lot of fun here too. Unless you make the wrong choice.
Today's episode of The Wicked Library is an encore performance of episode number 504, featuring remastered audio and a brand new interview with John Towers. The Wicked Library is brought to you by HorrorMade.com. From horror haikus to author and filmmaker interviews to original art and dark fiction reviews, HorrorMade.com has a terrifyingly fun collection of dark things that are sure to delight. Also brought to you by Shadows at the Door. Shadows at the Door is an ever-growing collection of haunted stories inspired by the ghastly, the ghoulish, and the macabre. You can enjoy the pleasing terrors and similar content at shadowsatthedoor.com. Also brought to you by Rickert & Beagle Books. Rickert & Beagle Books is a new, used, and rare bookstore located in Dormont, PA, specializing in science fiction, fantasy, horror, and weird nonfiction. Visit them on the web at rickertandbeaglebooks.com.
Warning, the Wicked Library contains adult themes, adult situations, adult language, and graphic depictions of terror, bloodshed, the occasional possession, and your future trips to your psychiatrist, so he or she can assure you it's only a story. This podcast is intended for mature audiences only. You've been warned, kiddies. Hello, kiddies. Have a seat and relax. I am your librarian. There's nothing to be afraid of, yet. Hold on to yourselves, boils and ghouls. This is going to be a dark ride. We'll leave the lights on for now. No talking. It's story time at the Wicked Library.
Smoke billows up from the city streets like it is trying to escape from the madness that is festering below. Pittsburgh looks like a ghost town from far away. None of the button-down professionals braved the commute today. A few of the blue-collar types made it in, the ones that didn't have any sick days left. And of course, the security guards made it in. They always made it in. Since the mosque on the north side was bombed, the city had been holding its breath, waiting for the other shoe to drop. Behind a broken window in a storefront, there is a television turned to a local news broadcast. Somewhere behind the fierce screams and angry chanting, the blonde talking head is calmly telling us all about the peaceful demonstration around the newly built Freedom City Center skyscraper. She calmly raises her eyebrow and says any violence must be the fault of the city's police force. Her TV studio is in a building with armed guards on the other side of town. The Caliphate rises! The phrase is screamed and pulses through the mob like a tidal wave. Teeth clenched, spit and raised fists. A wild pack of dogs scrapping for blood, cartilage, meat, bone. Ski masks, burning flags, AK-47s. The Shadow Caliphate rises! A glass bottle sails overhead. It is filled with searing pain, and it is on fire. The bottle smashes against the Freedom City Center. Flames coat the wall. The glass on the doors to the lobby are broken. The doors themselves have been locked for all the good that is going to do in a few minutes. There are cops in the lobby, and they are panicking. One is on his walkie-talkie pleading for help. What are rubber bullets gonna do? They have machine guns out there. Another one says, his eyes wide. He has a suicide vest. Away from the mob, a man with an explosive vest and a black mask breaks free from the other protesters. He walks towards the door, the terrified police officers. The man in the ski mask is quietly saying prayers. The one on the radio yelled, Jesus, I don't know what to do! Far above, on a window washer scaffold on a building across the street, hunkered Gretchen Cooper. 50 cal sniper rifle, binoculars, and a radio. She's holding the binoculars up to her pointy cat-framed glasses, her striking green eyes scanning, surveying. It had taken her a little longer to get into a position than she'd planned for, but the rest of the team should be in place. They went in through the parking garage on the opposite side of the building. She keys the mic. Even is out here with me in the truck, in case these riders go full-on war zone. SWAT team at the front doors. We'll use them as the first line of defense. They look spooked already. The crowd has AKs. I see a few RPGs. No lamp yet. Inside the building in the lobby, the boys are listening to Gretchen through earpiece radios. Shin is behind the cops, out of sight, out of mind. Shin Po Tan is behind the column, peering out. He looks like a ninja. Mask, suit, swords, and an AR-15. Stitch is the third line of defense. Stitch is further back, weapon in hand and full-on tactical vest, and underneath that, his trademark filthy white bodysuit he is sewn into. Axe and McCord are in the main elevator lobby. They are the last line of defense. Staff Sergeant McCord, the World War II era war bot, yellow eyes flashing, responds, "We all know our jobs. Let's get control over this thing before it gets started." Axe peers off, looking at the lane of approach. When this thing goes down, he must not let McCord get too far away from him. The boys hear the mic open again and Gretchen's voice. There is movement. The protester with the bomb vest is sprinting for the door. Broken glass. Scared cops. Gretchen is trying to shoulder the sniper rifle, but the bomber is moving very fast. The explosion is blinding. It opens up the whole front entrance of the building like a gaping wound. Through the smoke, Gretchen can see three more bombers running in right after. One of them disappears into the building. You couldn't even hear the cracks of the sniper rifle over the mob. The top of the third bomber's skull disappears, splintering skull, atomizing brain jelly. The fourth bomber's head briefly turned into a cloud of pink mist and disappears. Shin sees the bomber running toward the main elevator lobby, the center of the main part of the building. He has a giant scimitar drawn and raised over his head. Gretchen keys her mic. One is heading your way. You might not want to use your rifle. He's wired with C4. Shin ditches his assault rifle and draws his katana. The bomber sees Shin and yells his last words. The caliphate rises! A large white box truck is parked in an alley across from the protest. Sitting patiently inside the truck is Even, the stone golem. Rabbi Aronofsky was ducked down, hiding. Gretchen tells him to open the door and invite his friend to the party. This is all escalating rather quickly, the rabbi says to himself as he gets out and nervously walks to the rear of the truck. Didn't know it was going to be like this, he says as he grasps the handle of the truck. As the door swings open, the rabbi takes a deep breath and tilts his head up to look at his work. He allows himself to feel a little swell of pride. He says, almost as a prayer, Yasher Koach, Even the stone golem. Give him hell, son. At the edge of the protest, jihadists are screaming. The caliphate rises. The box truck is now wide open. The heavy-duty shocks on the back axle creaks and moans with relief. Even the stone golem stands, a monolithic slab of granite, easily 10 feet tall with 4 Hebrew letters carved into his chest. He is a monument crafted to honor the ancient god of war, the god of the Old Testament. Blood and thunder. Even the stone golem is here to honor that god and do his work. With impossibly heavy concrete cracking steps, he moves forward towards the mob. When the wild mad dog protesters see the stone golem, it is already too late for them. The golem rampages through their midst, arms and legs torn from sockets and joints sailing in the air. Jihadists folding in half violently. Blood, teeth, vomit. A swing of the mighty stone arm pulping people. Torn off heads fly through the air and roll onto the street. The ancient gray stone glistens with the blood of the enemy. One of them fires an RPG at the golem. The grenadier says to the man standing next to him, "Go, brother, you must deliver the lamp." The man beside him has an old brass lamp strapped to him. He says, "For the caliph!" and starts running away from the golem. He starts running for the smoking, gaping entrance to the doomed building. He is followed by another bomber. With the briefest flicker of chrome and blood, Shin's katana effortlessly pushes through a bomber's chest, slides deftly between his ribs, through his heart, and passed between two of his vertebrae. A third of the sword was sticking out of his back, and with a flick of his wrist, the blade turns him off like a light switch. The runner with the lamp and the suicide bomber who is running behind him approaches Shin. The runner jumps in the air and steps on the tip of Shin's sword. The runner springboards off the weapon and flips over Shin. Shin pivots around to have at the runner. He widens his stance and goes in high guard setting, ready to end this madness before it gets too far out of control. The bomber who is trailing behind the runner yells, "For the Shadow Caliphate!" As the bomber triggers his bomb, he yells, "The Caliphate rises!" It's blinding and loud. The vest packed with nails and rat poison. The nails to provide shrapnel. The rat poison to act as an anticoagulant. The runner takes cover and Shin takes the full brunt of the explosion. Did I mention how bright and loud it is? Through the smoke of the explosion, Stitch sees the runner. He brings up his rifle. Buzzing in his ear, he can hear Gretchen telling Shin to get out of the building.
"This is gonna be so titties," he says to himself.
Gretchen hardly ever lets him use guns. Before he pulls the trigger, he starts screaming,
"Rat-a-tat-tat! Rat-a-tat-tat!"
He squeezes the trigger. Bolt clacks, brass flies, bullets burst out. The runner, Stitch notices, is very fast and agile. He jumps up and kicks off the wall, literally dodging bullets like one of those French guys.
"Pew, pew, pew!"
Stitch yells, still blasting away at the runner. The runner spin kicks Stitch and rings his bell pretty good. He loses his rifle and he finds himself on his back, looking up at the runner who stands over him. The runner looks into Stitch's ice blue eyes. He says to Stitch in a low, serious tone, intensity flowing through him, hatred pulsing off of him, or maybe from within him. A beacon of everything terrifying, willful hatred.
"The Caliphate rises! Raise this, jerkface!"
While Stitch raised his right leg as fast and hard as he could into the crotch of the running jihadist, he raises his right hand and flips him the most serious middle finger ever flipped in recorded history.
Bam!
Stitch actually feels something break, or pop, or burst open on the business end of his combat boot, which is totally gross. McCord and Axe show up to lend support. They see the runner, obviously in serious pain. He has the lamp in his hand. Axe points his rifle.
"Get him, Sergeant!"
McCord cautions against firing since the nature of the lamp was unknown to them. There was no debate. No shots fired. It all happened so fast. The runner yells one last time, gasping through the intense pain that feels like it is running down his leg like hot butter.
"The Caliphate rises!"
Blue light exploded forth from the lamp as it opened. Something weird was happening with the air pressure. The sound of a high-speed train wreck was somehow coming from that little brass lamp. Gretchen could swear that the whole building buckled a little. Shin runs out of the gaping wound entrance of the building. He asks over the radio what was going on. Inside, McCord grabbed Stitch.
"Come on, Fort!
This is gonna suck," Stitch said.
A bright blue and orange flash shot from the ground floor up into the highest floor of the building. Gretchen could see it flashing up floor to floor, shattering a fault line of exterior glass all the way up the building. The building seemed to take a breath and then groan. The next explosion ripped through the building along the fault line and seemed to separate the doomed Freedom City Center. Another explosive surge cracking the building in half. It was almost like a punishment for somehow still standing. With that, the building started coming down on itself. One last victorious surge lighting up the sky with hatred. Gretchen could feel the heat and debris. She was speechless other than the words, prayer, whatever. Oh my God. Jihadists started to scatter as smoke and debris spewed forth. One runs past, even the stone golem yelling, "It is done! The walking fire is among us!" That guy looks really happy. Shin is hunched down, peering at the building coming down, trying to conceive how Axe, Stitch, and McCord could possibly live through this. "I can't see anything down here!" He tries his radio. "Axe! McCord!" Deep in the center of the collapsing building is a chaotic avalanche hell. Masonry, steel, broken glass, gravity. Axe and Stitch are standing next to McCord, who is shouldering a massive amount of falling wreckage. The Warbot is using fallen I-beams to leverage and distribute the weight of the crumbling building on his shoulders. Axe and Stitch are crouched under him. The Rabbi is weeping, watching the building as it and its pieces finally comes to a rest. There is no way anyone could have survived that. From his vantage point, he can see a blinding blue and orange light making its way out of the ruins of the building. The brilliant light casting long shadows of Shin and even the stone golem over the wreckage as they stand to meet the Djinn. The dirt and tears making muddy trails on the Rabbi's face. Monsters. They monsters. Dear God. Frantic, Gretchen keys her mic. "Shin, are you okay?" Shin answers her. "It's up to us now." Debris, smoke, lunatic screams. Gretchen fires back. "Us, and even the stone golem." "I am going in there to save the team," Shin admits. He looks at the ruins of the building. The new church of hatred. The altar of chaos. Gretchen protests for some reason. Shin interrupts. "They could still be alive." Half question, half prayer. Saria, the Djinn, emerges from the ruins of the building. A full 9 feet tall, with blue skin. The walking rage. The walking hatred. The walking fire. He is mostly bald, a ponytail lock of flames at the back of his head, his blue and orange flaming eyes. He wears the brass wrist bracers of a slave. He raises his arms to the sky.
"It is Allah's will that I once again war on the soil of my enemy."
His words echo through the surreal stillness. Death, destruction, wreckage. Somewhere in the chaos, a group of police officers are trying to make it to the building. One of them is run through with a scimitar.
"Riders!"
one of the cops yelled.
"The caliphate rises!"
surges, jump-starting the madness, running forms through clouds and smoke. The leader of the police officers shoulders his shotgun.
"This isn't a riot, it's a war zone!"
He uses the shotgun to open up any person not wearing a police uniform. Another cop sees the wreckage of the building through the smoke. It looks like a strange abandoned cathedral or something out of an old black and white picture of some distant world war. He pulls his radio.
"Freedom City Center is down! The whole damn thing is down!"
Another cop starts barking orders.
"Set up a perimeter! We must surround this chaos!" "Rises! Thank Allah! The caliphate rises!"
Yelling, half fear, half elation, half running away, half dances. crazy asses. Another cop on his walkie-talkie trying to be the lone voice of reason. We have to get out of here! The Dajin steps out into the street, out into the chaos. The sunlight struggles against the smoke and violence, muscles rippling under its pale blue skin. The Dajin smiles wide, his appetite wet for the carnage he will bring. Death, war, jihad. Across the street, even the stone golem approaches him, spattered in the blood of his enemies. Through the dark billowing smoke, the police officers see the two massive figures approaching each other. Jesus Christ, what are those? One yells. Both of the blotted out dark figures cock their arms back, both about to throw a punch. We gotta get out of here, another one adds. The Dajin and the golem's hands connect with massive force. Cracks splinter through even the stone golem's hand and up the great granite forearm. His fist starts to crumble, falling to the pavement.
I will return you to the sand, golem,
the Dajin declares triumphantly. Across the street, Shin scrambles up on the wreckage of the building. He is lifting large slabs of broken and damaged rubble over his head as he calls out for his buried team. He scans around looking for any sign of life. Axe! McCord! The Dajin and the golem are grappling now. Stone cracking, splintering like slate. Neck, choke, squeeze. The Dajin elbows his way out of a chokehold. A splintering star of damage erupts across the golem's chest. With a punch from the mighty Dajin, the left part of the golem's head atomizes to gravel. The Dajin hammers the golem's chest. Knuckle craters across the massive stone frame. With one last final blow, the golem crumbles to rubble. The Dajin stares into the smoke and addresses the world.
You send this hero magic to defeat me instead of meeting me head on. The way of the desert.
Holding his arms up triumphantly in the air, Saraya, the Dajin, screams to his enemies,
I will teach you the ways of the desert. I will teach you with my hands.
Shouldering the weight of the world, Gretchen's still up in her perch, watching the fierce warrior fall to the Dajin. She keys her mic, and trying to hide the surrender in her voice, asks, How do we stop him? He's unstoppable.
Stay tuned for a short Q&A with the author in just a moment. Today's episode featured a story by John Towers, Dajin Jihad. If you'd like more information on John's work, please visit stigmatastudios.com and visit John on Twitter at Johnny Axe. That's JonnyAxx. Artwork for today's show was created by John Towers. Big thanks to KB Goddard for a great story last week with The Darkness Within, and to Jeanette Andromeda for the kick-ass art. Don't forget to visit our sponsors, Shadows at the Door, RickertandBeagleBooks.com, HorrorMade.com, and SanitariumMagazine.com. Please share the terror. Share the show. Help us grow, won't you please? Tell a friend about us, or maybe even that guy who stares at you through his peephole. Aside from that, the best support you can give us is to rate us in iTunes. No, seriously, rate us in iTunes. It helps out the show. You can also rate us in Stitcher, TuneIn Radio. And the best part is, ratings are free. And we also like to read them. Don't forget to sign up for our newsletter to get great prizes, bonus content, and more. Sign up at thewickedlibrary.com. And now, John Towers. Today I have John Towers, and we just finished reading his, well, actually Nelson just finished reading, because this is an encore performance of the Dajin Jihad. Nelson and I decided we were going to take a few weeks to work on some other stuff and catch up on some projects and get ready for the Halloween special. And we never like to just go dead. So we always like to do like a best of type of thing. Mm-hmm. And that was the part that was hard for me, because when I looked at the prior seasons, to me, really all of the episodes are best ofs. So the reason I picked yours is because not only is it a great story, but it was interesting to me because it's a prose adaptation of a graphic novel. And usually, if I'm not mistaken, things go the other way, right?
Right. Yeah.
So what was it like to take the story that you created really for a visual medium and convert it into a written word?
It was actually stressful. It's kind of the hardest, one of the hardest things I've ever done, because I'm not really known for my words writing. And this is like my first like crack at doing it, you know, really well. So, and Nelson had already told me, that he would put the story on if I wrote it. So I felt like a lot of pressure because, you know, the Wicked Library is one of my favorite podcasts, and I didn't want to like lump some, you know, bullshit together and right. just have Nelson feel like he's obligated to put it on. So, I really took a lot of time with it and, you know, had a few people read it over. And, yeah, man, like to me, doing the words thing, because like I surround myself with writers and creative people, and like I was the only dude that's never been published, you know, with prose work. So I was like, oh man, this is like, you know, I just felt like a lot of like pressure from myself, yeah. You know, just to turn out some good work, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and full disclosure, I mean, Nelson often refers to you as the creator emeritus of the Wicked Library. So you have an in with the show anyway. And I appreciate what you're saying, because I mean, that people knowing that you have an in with the show, it's kind of like, I have to deliver even twice as good as the guy before me.
Yeah. Like, you know, it's hard to like quantify art or
yeah,
like stories like that, but certainly like, you know, cause the one little rule that I did break is I had it kind of set up beforehand. So like I didn't have to do the submission process like everybody else, you know?
Right.
So I was already kind of like, you know, I was already kind of like, putting myself out there. So I was like, certainly like, I wanted to do, like, I just wanted to have like the best story that I could possibly do, you know?
Yeah.
You know, based off of it's basically the third chapter of the graphic novel. Yeah.
Right.
So I picked that chapter. That's the one that I want to do, because it's got like most of the characters and stuff in it. And, you know, we get to like get a little POV from each of the good guys, and you know, it's got the main bad guy is kind of like revealed there at the end. And so I just targeted that one, and I was just like, I'm gonna write the shit out of this thing.
Yeah, I mean, you did a great job. It has everything that a great short story should. I mean, with a good short story, it's not like a novel or even a graphic novel where you have the time to kind of build up to the characters and to, you know, to build your universe and to get everybody on board. You pretty much have to drop right into the action and have something exciting and interesting and scary going on. And I think you did that really well.
Yeah. Well, thanks. And I mean, Nelson did such a great job with reading it and stuff, and I knew he would, you know, so like, yeah. Again, I was just like, you know, my first kind of foray into like, you know, worthy writing, I was like, you know, I just felt like I had to kind of pull the stops out on it. And one of the ways that I did that is I did the present tense, which was really difficult for me to write in. Like, it was super hard for me to do that.
And I'll tell you, that's one of the other things that drew me to the story, because it's not a common way to write. And it is very, very difficult to write that way. And I think you did a really cool job with it.
Yeah, like at first I was just like, yeah, I'll just do it this way. Like, how difficult can it be? And I'm like rereading it like 100 times, and I just keep finding past tenses in there. And I'm like driving myself crazy for it. But I feel like when you do write in that tense, it's like it helps put you like in a real good observer position. Like, you're kind of in the middle of it, because it's not, you don't have that, you know, it's not past. So like, you know, psychologically, I feel like it puts you like right there with the characters and the events that are unfolding.
Yep. Yep. It's definitely a very, it's a faster moving, it's more immediate. But again, it is very difficult, because almost everything we're exposed to is past tense. So, I mean, I know you're a big reader, And, you know, that's kind of what we become used to as readers, and therefore what we become used to as writers is everything occurring in the past tense.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's like a, like an advertising trick or like an Edward Bernays kind of thing, but it just seemed like that little tweak really affected the way that the story was to me. You know, like I had written it in, you know, in past tense, you know, as well, mm-hmm. you know, in that's where I kind of shifted fire and was like, no, I'm going to put him right in the middle of this, you know? So, yeah. But definitely the hardest part was that. That was the hardest part. But there's also some challenges too, because when you're working with the comic now, like I write and I illustrate the comic book. So usually I don't have to describe the things that are around the action right. because I already control that, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like the biggest departure, I think, is I did the monologue for the internal monologue for Stitch, like where he gets the gun and he's like, titties, like that's not in the book. Like, that's just what he was thinking to himself. So, you know, I had to kind of think about that stuff because, like his character was not well represented until I wrote that, you know?
Right. When you're writing your comics, I mean, do you write the story and the dialogue at the same time, or do you draw first, well, like storyboard?
No.
You usually go.
No, like it's well, I'm like I know, I'm like tyrannically obsessive. Like I like outline, thumbnail, script, draft. You know, rewrites. So, I definitely do all the writing and stuff first, and the main reason is because. Like with comics, like when you're dealing with word writing, like that's what it is. It's not a page count. It's a how many words you got in something, right?
Right.
But in comics, it's about the page count, you know, because you have to figure out how much real estate you have to figure out the best way to tell, you know, your story with the pages that you have. So I commonly refer to it as real estate. I don't know if it makes sense to everybody or not, but and then you have to like look, you know, how many panels are going to be on the page? How do you arrange them? And with the graphic novel, kind of like limited myself in that because every page of the graphic novel is a representation of the golden ratio. Like I did this mind trick with it. So I had like that limitation, you know, where I can only do like set up so much of a joke or an action piece, you know, before I get run into that, the big panel where I have to pay it off, you know?
Right.
But, you know, so that was cool getting to explore, you know, not having to do that, you know, when I'm actually writing the story. So.
And now you've actually written some additional prose, right?
Yeah. I mean, with, the story that Nelson read, I went ahead and got published in, the Dreadful Geographic, I believe it's coming out this month or next month, at Forsaken.
Okay.
It's a brand new publishing company. So yeah, like that came right out of Nelson reading that story on the Wicked Library. So, you know, it was really cool.
That's really cool. It's always nice to hear that, you know, a writer gets an opportunity from the show because, I mean, as you know, that's kind of the whole design and the guts of it is that, you know, we're here to promote the authors and the artists and to get people opportunities. So it's nice to hear that actually happened for you.
Yeah, man. And it actually happened pretty fast. Like, correct me if I'm wrong, if you even know, but I believe the story was like in the middle of last season was when that episode originally aired. And, you know, it was only out there for like maybe a month or whatever, where Nelson was like, hey, I have someone who wants to talk to you about writing a short story for this book. So, you know, that was awesome. And it's, Maddie Von Stark, you know, she's no stranger to your show for sure.
Right. She was the art director for, I think, three or four of the seasons of the show.
And, yeah.
She was pretty involved in doing the covers for pretty much all the shows up until the beginning of this season. You know, she moved on to do some stuff with Book Trope, and obviously it created an opportunity for us to open up the doors and bring in some new artists and kind of get some new voices, so to speak, out there. But yeah, you were originally 504, the fourth episode of season five. So,
oh, okay. Yeah. So, but yeah, you know, Maddie, she's been on my podcast before, and a couple times, and you know, she just reached right out. The thing that you said about the opportunities and stuff with the podcast, it's really cool, and I feel like that opportunity that I had, you know, coming right from the show is like the perfect example of how like the show is like is designed and built. You know, you get such a great reader, you know, actor or whatever, like Nelson, you know, saying words that you wrote is crazy. And then like a direct benefit, right, you know, coming right from, I mean, that experience itself is awesome.
It's interesting because, you know, I mean, there's not really a lot of other shows out there that kind of do what the Wicked Library does. And I think it's very unique in that way. And it creates a lot of opportunities for not only the authors, but, you know, for the listeners as well to hear stuff in a way that they probably never would.
Otherwise. Right. And then like, you know, when you took over, you know, you expanded that same model out to artists. And it's like, it is so awesome to see, you know, a different style of art, like every week. And I know the care you take into like developing those relationships and figuring out which artist, you know, would work best. I imagine that you put a ton of time into that.
Yeah.
So it could be someone like me who's been out there, you know, rocking and rolling for, you know, over, you know, 10 years now, or it could be someone that no one's ever heard of before. And it's getting the same, like, you know, whatever your listenership is, that same amount of eyes, you know, on there. It's something that's so unique, you know, like it's just so crazy. I'm happy to be a part of that side of it too.
Yeah. And that's one of the other things that's really cool is that, you know, I got to use your art for your episode this time around. And, right. You know, you've done art for the show three times this season, I think, as of the recording of this. So you did Stuck for Caitlin Marceau. You did Scalene Love Triangle for Carrie Lipp, and you did Train Man for Cindy Lohman. And now, of course, you know, we got an encore performance of yours and your artwork on there. And people will recognize it instantly because they can go right over to Amazon.com and pick up a copy of the graphic novel with the same cover.
Yeah, yeah. And it's cool because, like, you just walked me through those little art projects, and it's like, it's funny because I did all of them, and I used the same process to do all of them, but they all look totally different, you know? So it's like, it's cool to see, like, a repeat offender.
Yes. We definitely like that. We definitely like that. Well, you know, I wanted to ask you, whenever you're developing a panel, that's the correct term, right? A panel is one encapsulated scene.
Panel or frame. Yeah. Which you can use either one.
Okay. So when you're working on that individual frame or that individual panel, how do you go about picking the image that's just the right moment? Because some panels cover a very short period of time, but if I'm not mistaken, some frames there's events that occur and you're just picking one image to represent that sequence.
Well, sometimes there's rules like the big comic book rule is when you're drawing like something like a punch, you never draw it connecting. You either draw like the wind up or the follow through. Like it's never like the Vulgar Display of Power Pantera album cover where it's just knocking the guy's block off. Like you never see that in a comic book. Like it's always right before or right after. So there's that. Then there's also like, I do this occasionally, but guys like, you know, Frank Miller does this really well where he'll play with the depth of the gutter. Like he's dealing with the space in between the panels to kind of subliminally tell you that more time's passed between this frame and this frame, or he'll shorten it up if less time, you know, does that. He doesn't do that all the time, but you know, he's guilty of doing that. And I think that's like a really cool kind of idea.
Yeah.
As far as like what's happening on the actual frame, I kind of think about it as like a storyboard for a movie. Like you plot out like the important stuff, right? Or like if it's like a character moment, then you like you arrange your characters to where they can, you know, you can see the emotion on the face, you know.
Right.
So there's a lot of different factors that go into it.
That's very interesting.
It's kind of like you got to think about it as like you're the writer, the casting director, the
I'm familiar with that experience.
The guy that's in charge of running the camera, you know, the guy, you know, you're telling everyone where to stand and like what they're going to say. Yeah. But as far as dialogue and stuff is concerned, going back to a question that you asked me before, you know, I take full advantage of every piece of my process to do editing. So like, if I get there, like, say I'm, like, 75% done with something, and I look at it, I'm like, oh, well, I need to tweak this frame, like, I'll draw that frame on a different piece of paper, you know, and I'll scan it in and gimmick it up, and then just paste it on top, like, to fix the art, or, like, go into Photoshop and kind of, you know, clean something up, mm-hmm. or, you know, that goes even for, like, dialogue, like, if I'm like, oh, no, like, it'll be so much cooler if he did this or said this instead. Like, I'll just change dialogue, like, in any kind of part of my process. Like, right. I take full editorial advantage of that. So I don't get, like, too locked in, you know, to that. And, like, if you ever see, like, my original pages, like, I'll pencil scribble notes to myself in. Like, hey, when I scan this page or when I'm lettering this page, I'm going to want this guy to see this, you know, or whatever. So it's like I'm always kind of managing my process as I'm going through it.
Yeah. No, that's, and you know, it's something I guess you have to be mindful of, because whenever you're doing dialogue for a comic, typically the dialogue appears in frame with the characters and can obscure part of your art. I mean, it's going to obscure part of your artwork. So you have to, to pick what it's going to show, what it's going to hide at that point.
Yeah.
I noticed that when I was working with Steve on you know, a little side project that we did whenever I took over the Wicked Library, where we did kind of Victoria Meets the Librarian. It was a really fun experience, but that was one of the things that it broke my heart sometimes. I'm like, I don't want to obscure this, but it has to go here.
yeah, you got to totally be mindful about that kind of stuff. And it's like, you know, 13 years into this adventure for me, like, I do it subconsciously most of the time.
Yeah.
Like, I'll be like, you know, he's getting pretty wordy here, you know, like, I gotta, like, let him chew up some background, or in this one, like, he's not saying anything, so I could go nuts, you know,
yeah,
with all the visual information. So, and it's kind of different, too, because, like, we talk often about, like, the difference between novels and short stories, mm-hmm. and that same stuff applies to comic books, too. Like, you know, when you're dealing with a graphic novel, you know, it's basically, like, way more like different kind of storytelling than when you're working on like a comic book series. Mm-hmm. You know, when you work on a comic book series, it becomes soap opera ish, you know, mm-hmm. like, cause it just keeps going and going and going. But with a graphic novel, like, you need to have a beginning, middle, and end, you know? So,
yeah.
You know, there's all kinds of like stuff that you got to think about. And those are gears that I shift all the time, like, depending on what I'm working on. Cause I do, you know, comics and web comics and graphic. Now I do the whole nine yards. Yeah. And it's always like, well, am I going to need to bunch this up as a trade paperback at some point in time? Or is this going to be, you know, you always got to be mindful about that kind of stuff, I guess.
No, that's really cool. And I think that, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I like doing the interviews and sharing that with the listeners of the show, is because I think there's a lot that we can learn from the way that different writers do their work. And definitely, since you are working in a slightly different medium, I think that there's new ways of looking at things, like conceptualizing some of this stuff. I'm already having ideas for different ways that I could write prose.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, that's like the biggest lesson that I learned in college was process. And I remember when I figured it out, I was sitting in a typography class, and like, for people that aren't like graphic designers or aren't like, get, you know, boners thinking about typography, like, it could be possibly like, and there are dudes that are like that, by the way, like, people get real into type. Anyhow, uh-huh. like, you're sitting there and you're like, okay, so, you know, I have thumbnails, and then I walk, you know, then I do a markup on like sketch paper and like do a couple different versions of it. And then I got to, you know, start working on my final, and then I got to like do finishing touches and stuff. And it seems basic, right? Like, yeah, of course that's what you have to do. But like, it, once you learn that process, you can apply it to anything. Like, when I sit down to write, that's how, you know, that's how I do it. A lot of people would call it like unpacking. Like, I'll start with a sentence and be like, oh no, I got to add on to that shit, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and you just kind of build, you know, your message, whatever you're messaging.
That's really cool.
But the book was a ton of fun to do. You know, basically I set out to do like, I wanted to do like a big summer crossover event, but I wanted to be like real indie, have a real indie sensibility. And I don't know if anyone's ever done anything like that before. But I had a blast doing it. And, you know, thanks for, you know, you guys for listening and, you know, buying, the book, people who have. So yeah, it was just a real fun thing. And I just kind of wanted to do something, you know, like totally different.
So before we run, do you want to talk real quick about where people can find more about your process and how to draw comics the Stigmata way?
Oh yeah. Like, my little studio is called Stigmata Studios. You can find it online, stigmatastudios.com. And, there's free comics up there. You can go read some free web comics if you guys don't feel like forking out clams. The podcast is there. You can check that out. And then under the video section, I have a video series. Basically, it's how to draw comics the Stigmata way. And, the first season, basically I filmed like every step of my process going through while I was actually working on the Jihad book. So, if you guys want to like literally look at me while I'm doing what I'm just kind of talking about, you can do that. The second season was all about me marketing the book. My publisher shifted from a March 2015 to a September 2014 date. So they kind of pulled the rug out from under me as far as like, you know, getting all my shit together. So, you know, if you want to see videos of me at 3 o'clock in the morning trying to figure out how to use Twitter, like that's not somewhere.
Well, you know, and I want to point out with that too, that a lot of the times, one of the things that I hear most commonly from writers is that they struggle with ways to use social media and connect with their fans in an effective way. And I will say that you have some really great ideas, tips, secrets, whatever you want to call them, throughout the series there. So if you know, for those that are writers or aspiring writers that are listening, this guy will have some true information to drop on you in those videos.
Yeah, there's a lot of social media marketing tips. And it all, like, I was kind of poking fun at myself earlier about the 3 o'clock in the morning trying to figure out how to use Twitter thing. But in all seriousness, like, I put it up. It's free. You know, every creative kind of person, anyone thinking about writing something next year, and you want to build, you know, your tribe, or you want to, like, whatever all these internet marketing people say, like, if you want to start building on your base and stuff, like, I show all that using Twitter. And I think the one that I kind of skipped out on was Facebook, because I'm kind of burnt out on Facebook. But yeah, you know, I talk about Pinterest, I talk about Instagram, I talk about hashtag management, all that kind of stuff. And I just put it up there for you guys for free. So, you know, if you want to go check that out. And then I started the third season, but I kind of just run out of time to do them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that's also, there's like fun stuff. Like, I do drink recipes, and I strung up a barbed wire baseball bat for a wrestler buddy of mine. And I just, there's all kinds of goofy stuff on there too. But, yeah, the process stuff is real good. And, the social media marketing stuff is fantastic. And, you know, I point people to that all the time. You know, whenever I hear someone like, I can't figure Twitter out, I'm like, haha, you come to the right dude. Like,
well, where can folks get the book?
You can go to stigmatastudio.com, and it has a link to the Amazon there, or you can just search me out on Amazon. I got e-comic books up on Amazon for Kindle, exclusively. I got my two graphic novels are up there. If you want some trade paperbacks of like the non-standard assembly books, there's three fantastic looking paperbacks. You could just go follow the link that's on my website. It's that comics link. You'll be able to find it all there.
Awesome. And of course, I mean, I'll have links over to your site and all your stuff in the show notes for this episode too. So to make it real easy, people can just go right over to the episode show notes and pick that up.
Awesome.
But I really appreciate you letting us rerun your episode and get it out there to folks. I mean, I don't want to, it's not really in my heart, it's not a rerun. It's an encore, because I think it's something that the newer fans, I mean, we've grown our audience significantly in the last, you know, several months. So it's something that I really wanted the newer fans to be able to listen to and to enjoy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I really should be thanking you, you know, for rerunning it. You know, 'cause it's hard. And, you know, like, it's hard to find kind of like evergreen content, you know,
right.
But I think that you found a great way to develop that with the library, the actual physical stories that are in the library.
Oh yeah. We get a lot of submissions now, which is really cool. It's just, you know, there comes a time whenever you're like, hey, we need to take a little break here and work on a couple other things for a few weeks or we're going to be buried. You know, because then everything starts to suffer. So I thought the best thing to do is pick some of the really cool episodes from the past seasons. I picked some of my favorites and get them out there for folks to enjoy. But yeah, we definitely appreciate all the submissions that we get, because there's some really great stories that are coming in, and we're actually going to be running a long season, longer than any other Wicked Library season yet. I may cut this, but no, we're going to be doing episodes.
Oh my God. That's crazy. Dan, how long does it take for you to actually produce an episode? It's gotta be like, I would say probably like 40 hours, right? I would say that's what it would be.
From scratch?
Reading, like from the minute you...
If I count everything, the number gets a lot higher. If I count like sitting down, reading the story, editing it, putting the music behind it, writing the show notes, posting it up to the website, getting the links and everything out, you're probably talking about a good 12 to 14 hours. If I count everything, including... you know, reading it and, you know, getting in touch with the authors and going through the slush pile. And, you know, for a while there, we were doing three stories from each author. So I would read all three stories, and now I'm down to one, or at the top, two stories from every author. And I've also cut the word count down because we're doing the interviews now. So, you know, right. I try to keep the show under an hour, you know, on the top end. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of time that goes into it for sure, because I think that all the stories deserve that love.
Right. Yeah. I just think that I'm not that I'm worried or whatever, but like, it's hard, you know, if people aren't podcasters or people aren't, you know, performers or whatever, you know, it might be difficult for them to realize how much time goes into that, you know. And then you're also talking about the time that the writers are writing the stories. You're also talking about the time where the artists are doing the artwork for the stories, right. You know, like there, you know, it's easy just to forget, because like on my podcast, it's just me and another idiot babbling, you know, for an hour. Like I don't have to.
I've been on your show before. I've been that other idiot.
I don't have to, you know, do prep. Like I don't have to reread the story and do a bunch of editing and stuff. So yeah, I think it's commendable, man. And you're doing such a great job with it. And, you know, congratulations on all your success and getting game in. That was awesome.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, I mean, I think that the writers know, because I mean, what you see on the final page that takes, you know, maybe if you sit down and read it straight through 6 hours, 8 hours, it depends on how fast you read and how big the thing is. But I mean, you know, if you sit down and you read a short story, like one of the ones that we feature on the show, you might read that in, you know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. But that author spent probably, you know, days, weeks, even writing and rewriting and redrafting and coming up with the story. So you don't see that. It's, you know, it's what happens behind the curtain. You're not supposed to. It's, you know, it's the magic that, you know, that makes everything happen. But yeah, there's definitely a lot that goes into it. And, you know, I don't mind it, because I love story and storytelling, and you know, I love the stories that we get in, and I love making them into something special for the writers, because they really deserve that. And, you know, the artists too, you know, they deserve to get that exposure and to get their work seen. And I hope that the listeners and, you know, the folks that go to the website and look at the covers and everything, you know, go back and visit those authors and go back and visit those artists and support them, because that's why we do this, is because we want people to see, appreciate, and enjoy what we make.
Right. So. Yeah. I mean, and you guys, you're just rocking and rolling, man. You're doing a fantastic job.
Well, I appreciate that, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
So John Towers, the podcast that John does is called Red Horse Radio. You can find all his stuff over at stigmatastudios.com, and you can also find links in the show notes.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Hey, thanks for coming by, John, virtually.
Right. All right, Dan. Thanks a lot, man. Hey, no
problem. All works read in this audio recording and associated music and artwork are copyright of their respective creators and may not be used in any form without their permission. Dramatic reading performed by Nelson W. Piles. Remember him? The voice of the librarian was performed by Nelson W. Piles. The voice of Victoria Bigglesworth Hayes was performed by Amber Collins. The Wicked Library theme was written by Anthony Rousek and performed by Novus. All other music in this episode was performed by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com and used with his permission. The Wicked Library is a Ninth Story Studios production, NinthStory.com. Producer, Daniel Foytek. Program Director, Caitlin Marceau. Executive Producer and Creator, Nelson W. Piles. Full show notes and links and artwork can be found at www.thewickedlibrary.com/BS5-1. Until next time, this has been Daniel Foytek. Go ahead, leave the lights on.
Just make sure the lamp you use doesn't contain an evil genie.
Music, talk, stories, politics. This is the Society 13 Podcast Network. Kettle Whistle Radio. Music, The Wicked Library, stories. Mouthing off. Progress. Politics. GBA with Mr. Pink. Talk. The Ninth Story. Music. Red Horse Radio. Politics. Society 13. Where bad... I can't say that. Where Naughty Donkeys listen to podcasts.
Society 13. Where Naughty Donkeys...